Well, tonight we continue our series on church history. And tonight, Lord willing, we're going to finish volume one of Nick Needham's five-volume series on church history, 2,000 Years of Christ's Power. We'll be finishing the patristic age of church history of the early church fathers. We, in the 600s, but roughly they say around 600 AD is when the patristic age ends. And then the next time we meet, Lord willing, we'll see the arrival of Islam and the beginning of the Middle Ages. Well, as we've seen, the patristic age focused heavily once Constantine was converted, after he got control of the East in 324 AD and became the emperor of the entire empire, is when he saw this huge controversy in the East, Arianism. Arianism, remember, said that Jesus was a mere man, not God incarnate. So he immediately called the Council of Nicaea together, First Ecumenical Council in 325 AD, a year later. And he was very active in that council as well. And they clearly declared that the Logos, the eternal Son of God, added to himself human flesh, that Jesus is truly God, not just truly man. The Nicene Creed was amended in 381, Council of Constantinople, the first Council of Constantinople, and that's the Nicene Creed that we have today. Well, the controversy didn't end there. It continued, and there was a council at Ephesus in 431 AD, clarifying further the person of Christ. But the big one was the Council of Chalcedon, 451 AD. I've read it now a couple of times, the Council of Chalcedon, and it may be worth reading it again, because we'll be referring back to it as we're in the East divided. Remember the West, with the fall of Rome, the city of Rome, in 410 AD, 476 AD, the imperial insignia was sent to the East. From there on, the East is called the Byzantine Empire, and that's where the emperors were. There was no more emperor in the West after 476 AD. We had looked at last time, the East was extremely divided into four main groups. The Monophysites, that said Jesus merely had one nature. The Diophysites, that focused on two natures but were fuzzy on his person. The Cyrillian Chalcedonians, they were the ones that followed the Chalcedon Creed of 451. They were the Orthodox Christians. All of the West were Chalcedonians of the Christians in the West. But in the East, the main group was the Cyrillian Chalcedonians, but the Monophysites was a very large group, and the smallest was the Origenists, following Origen of Alexandria. But they were very divided, and we looked at that the last time we met, and the division still continues, and we're going to look at the Monophysite controversy, continuing to assert their views, but we're going to look at first, this particular writer that claimed to have written certain writings. We don't know who wrote it, but we're going to look at mysticism and a pretty good, clear presentation of what mysticism is. But the Chalcedon Creed, I want to read this before we get going here. And we've read it before, but I'll read it again. Creed of Chalcedon, 451 AD. We all with one voice confess our Lord Jesus Christ, one and the same Son, at once complete in deity and complete in humanity, truly God and truly man, consisting of a rational soul and body, of the same essence as the Father in his deity, of the same essence as us in his humanity, like us in all things apart from sin, begotten of the Father before all ages regards his deity, the same born of the Virgin Mary, the birth giver of God, as regards his humanity, in the last days for us and our salvation. One and the same Christ, Son, Lord, only begotten, to be acknowledged in two natures, without confusion, without change, without division, without separation, the distinction of the natures being in no way abolished because of the union, but rather characteristic property of each nature being preserved, and coming together to form one person and one hypostasis. He is not split or divided into two persons, but he is one and the same Son and only begotten, God the Logos, the Lord Jesus Christ, as formerly the prophets and later Jesus Christ himself have taught us about him, as it has been handed down to us by the creed of the fathers. Very clear definition, excluding lots of errors that we have covered. The Nestorian error, you remember, of separating two natures and one person within each nature, so that he was two persons and two natures. Monophysites are saying, we're going to get the monothelite controversy this evening, but the monophysite controversy is one nature. Monothelite will be saying one will, which is a whole different perspective. It's not a mixture where they're confused, where it's one person, one divine human nature. It's one nature that has both qualities of divine and human, as if they're all mixed. It's not that. He is one person with two natures. And the question we'll be pondering then is, what goes with personhood? What goes with nature? We've already talked about Apollinarius and his error, saying the divine mind replaced the human mind, and that was rejected. Tonight we're going to see another perspective with energy and then with will. Everybody keeps thinking of new ideas to try and bring the Chalcedonians with the Monophysites together, and they end up further into heresy again. But it will be rejected. The monothelite perspective will be rejected as well, with the brilliant theology of Maximus the Confessor. So let's look at this writing here, supposedly from Dionysius. This is all in the East again. The East divided. This is number 3 under the outline here. Pseudo-Dionysius and the negative way. Nicnita points out that doctrine and spirituality developed uniquely in the East. And this is something that was unique in the East. These writings, supposedly by Dionysius the Areopagite, because supposedly, if you look at Acts chapter 17, verse 34, one of those converted when the Apostle Paul was on the Areopagus, Mars Hill in Athens, one of those is named Dionysius in Acts 17, 34. Or, there's a body of writings at this time that claim to be from one of Paul's converts at Athens. Supposedly that Dionysius that's mentioned. For 1,000 years, the church accepted these writings as written by Dionysius. Ended up being doubted in the 15th century, 1400s A.D., and it was disproved in the 19th century. So in these bodies of writings, there are four main writings: the divine names, mystical theology, celestial hierarchy, and the ecclesiastical hierarchy. They're called pseudo-Dionysius writings. And pseudo is Greek for false. In other words, they're claimed to be written by Dionysius, but we know that they're not. But the one writing of the main four, called mystical theology, Nick Needham calls a masterpiece of mysticism. A masterpiece of mysticism. And it's important for us, there's a lot of mysticism in our day and age. Okay? And that's where I thought, well, should I include this or not? It's only so much space on the board. And I thought, it is important, I think, so that each one of us has a pretty good idea what mysticism is. Many of the 1960s radicals were mystics. Okay? Well, mystical theology says God is beyond human understanding. So we cannot say what God is, but only what God is not. Now, think in your mind with me. It is true that in some things we say what God is not. When we say He is infinite, we're saying He's not finite. He's not limited. When we say He is immutable, we're saying He does not change. We're saying what He is not. He doesn't change. Right? So, it is true that we have some assertions of God saying what He is not. But the mystics say this is the only thing you can say about God is what He is not. That the mystics would say God is beyond human understanding. It'd be one thing to say that you and I in our minds that are rational have limits. So we cannot fully comprehend God. He's incomprehensible. We cannot know Him completely or fully. True. And yet He is rational, and we're rational, and we can, with our human minds, rationally understand some truths about God positively. The mystics would say that we cannot even say that God exists because our minds cannot understand existence. The mystics held that to approach God, the soul, and we have a rational soul, this is human reason, that the soul must pass through a threefold discipline of purification, illumination, and union. Purification, illumination, and union. Interestingly, it parallels the Neoplatonist three stages for the soul to ascend up to the One. It had degrees of reality in Neoplatonism, that new form of Plato's thinking that was made into a religion, and Augustine of Hippo for a while had embraced Neoplatonism. And he actually, just as a side note, he gives credit to Neoplatonism that brought him to Christianity. So just because something has falsehoods in it doesn't necessarily mean God can't use it to bring someone to Christianity. Now, what are these three stages? Purification, illumination, and union. So mystics have a very low perspective on human reason, human mind. And R.C. Sproul has said, we live in perhaps the most anti-intellectual age in the history of the church. That's what mysticism is, something that is around us in our day. Well, the first stage is purify your understanding of God entirely from senses and logical reason. You know, the physical senses, right? With the eyes, you see, your nose, what you smell, your mouth, what you taste, your ears, what you hear, your hands, what you feel, right? The physical senses. So they would say, purify your understanding of God entirely from senses and logical reason. Just anything logical, purify it, remove it. Anything from senses, remove it. Now, this clearly contradicts the Bible. Romans 1:20, for example. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, His eternal power and Godhead are clearly seen, being understood from the things that have been made. Clearly seen, being understood by the things that have been made through scientific inquiry, through the senses and reason, pondering what you're experiencing. So this is a clear rejection of Romans 1:20, for example. But this is what the mystics would say. Nothing with the human mind, nothing with physical senses. You've got to be passive, not active, passive, and let God bring the soul into union with Himself. This is where you get toward almost like the Buddhism of meditation, where you're passively just, you put the brain on the shelf, and supposedly God's supposed to be active then, and you're passive. Christian yoga. It's a form of mysticism, Christian yoga. And supposedly then, they say this leads, for you're passive, totally purging yourself of anything physical senses, anything of human reason, logic, all of that, and then God is active, bringing your soul into union with Himself, and it leads to spiritual illumination, union with God in love. And you say, well, what is that idea? Because when I ask the question, what is that idea that you're asserting? Well, then you're using the mind. So it's self-contradictory, really, when you think about it. Because what is love, then? You can't be 1 Corinthians 13:6 that love rejoices in the truth. We're talking about truth that you can express with words that's rational. This is totally experiential, totally feelings, totally experiential, really. And at the end, then, the union, then, with God in love leads to the souls sharing God's glory and immortality. And in the East, they would speak of, Athanasius spoke that way too, who died 373 AD, of deification. What they mean is that we do not become God, but that, like 2 Peter 1:4, we become partakers of the divine nature. That we share in God's glory and immortality at that point. Through that mystical, mysterious, non-rational, non-physical senses experience. And in their mind, the mystics' mind, a soul must confess its inability to know God. This is referred to then as the negative way. The inability to know God, a denial that I myself, I've just got to be passive doing that Christian yoga thing. That is not Christianity. It's not Christianity. We're to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. Romans 12:2. The East tended to really distrust relying too much on human reason to know God. Tertullian kind of embraced some mysticism. He really did not like philosophy. Okay, Tertullian of Carthage died 225 AD. We talked about him some already. And I put on the board too, they tended to believe that the whole of creation was organized in groups of three. So they tended to see the Trinity mirrored all over the place. That was just an interesting side note on that. But that's mysticism. So if you come across mysticism, have kind of this in the back of your mind, say this is not biblical, but we have lots of mystics running around in our day right now. Everything's nothing more than feelings. Put the brain on the shelf. Don't think. It's all over the place. As Amy's nodding her head. Yeah. Yes, I agree. And that's where they're opening themselves up to demonic activity. Okay, so that's pseudo-Dionysius in the negative way. So, again, there's nothing new under the sun, really. A lot of this stuff gets rehashed. So if we can learn from church history, then we're better prepared to address falsehoods in our day. Right? How they think, we can address it and say it's false. Okay, that's number three in the outline. Number four, the monothelite controversy and Maximus the Confessor. And this is a very important one again because we're on the doctrine of salvation. Who is Christ? In Matthew 16, when Jesus looked at the disciples, who do you say that I am? Well, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. What does that mean? The Byzantine Empire made one last attempt to bring the Chalcedonians and the Monophysites together. So the Chalcedonians, remember, very clear, I just read the Creed of Chalcedon, 451 AD. Christ is truly God, truly man, two natures, in one person. But those natures don't get mixed or confused in any way. They maintain their separate qualities. So again, we've said, if Christ did a miracle or calmed the sea, it was in his divine nature he did that. He was born, he grew, he hungered, he thirsted, he died. In his human nature he did. But yet we say, Jesus calmed the sea, Jesus died at the cross. Two natures united in one person. God incarnate. Monophysites, no, they said physis in the Greek for nature, mono, one, one nature. One person, one nature. Remember Epictetus, he said the human nature was like a drop of wine in the ocean. It was lost in the divine nature. And really then, one person, one nature, and they tend to speak as a blending, like he's part human, part God, a human divine nature. Well, the dilemma is you deify the human and you humanize the divine when you do that. God would cease to be God if he in any way lost true, full divinity. Well, they make one last attempt to bring the Chalcedonians and Monophysites together. Recover Justinian the Great. His death occurred in 565 AD. Monophysites were being persecuted at this time. And Emperor Heraclius, Heraclius, he was emperor 610 to 641 AD in the Byzantine Empire. And let me just say, before I continue, what's on the board is because the Monophysites had been persecuted, they were beginning to look for foreign enemies as allies, like from Persia and other places. So the emperor here is getting nervous, Emperor Heraclius, that all of these Monophysites running around in the Byzantine Empire may ally with my foreign enemies. I've got to find some way to unite the Monophysites and the Chalcedonians, okay? So he's thinking a little bit more in terms of the empire itself and its security. And Nick Needham brings that out in his volume. Well, he looked to the patriarch Sergius of Constantinople. Remember, there was five patriarchs in the Catholic Church. Remember, anything before the Protestant Reformation of the 1500s AD, it's the Catholic Church. After the Protestant Reformation, it's the Roman Catholic. At that time, in the Catholic Church, there were five patriarchs, the way the government polity, the church government, was structured. One patriarch in the West, in Rome, called the Pope. Carthage had been wiped out, so there was not one there. So Rome was the only one in the West. In the East, though, it was Alexandria, the patriarch, one in Jerusalem, one at Antioch, and one at Constantinople. Total of five patriarchs. So this is one of the five top leaders here, Sergius of Constantinople. And Constantinople, you remember, after Chalcedon in 451, was vying to take out Rome as the lead patriarch, the first among equals, in a sense. Sergius, S-E-R-G-I-U-S, Sergius of Constantinople, he was 610 to 638 A.D. He said union, perhaps, between the Chalcedonians and the Monophysites could be achieved around a formula of a single energy in Christ. That in Christ, there's a single energy. Energia in Greek meant action, activity, or work, revealing a thing's nature. That was the traditional patristic understanding, that it revealed a thing's nature. What its action is, its activity, or its work. So an example is the sun shines with heat and light, revealing its sunny nature. The sun that you and I see and observe shines and has certain activity. It shines with heat and light, revealing its sunny nature. So the key question is, how could Christ be one person if he has two natures, right? This is the fundamental question between the Chalcedonians and the Monophysites. How could Christ be one person if he has two natures? The Council of Chalcedon says, it's true, it's what the Bible reveals, but it's mysterious. I don't truly fully understand it, this hypostatic union. Remember, the Monophysites said one person, and his two natures became a single divine human nature. The eternal Son of God with the incarnation went and blended them into one single divine human nature. That's the Monophysites. Where the Chalcedonians said one person, two distinct natures, forever. And that's the biblical view. So the question is energy that Sergius is putting forth here of Constantinople, is energy something different from nature and person? Sergius said energy belonged to person rather than to nature. Your activity, your work, you a thing, your activity, your work, energy. And he says it belongs to personhood, not nature. The traditional understanding is belong to nature, your activity or work that you do. So Sergius is saying that Christ exercised his one personal energy through his two natures so that there was one single divine human activity that pervaded everything he did. Sergius is trying to say that all Christ's actions were divine and human at the same time. The activity, the energy, was human and divine all at the same time. He's mixing and confusing what Chalcedon Creed said. It's not to be confused or mixed. And really, then what Sergius is saying, that if Christ had two natures in any way, it's just in theory, but not really in practice, that the energy and the activity are one. Well, a certain patriarch was elected in Jerusalem, Sophronius, Sophronius. Sophronius of Jerusalem. He was a Chalcedonian. He was elected Patriarch of Jerusalem in 634 AD. He lived 560 to 638 AD. So he's elected to be the Patriarch of Jerusalem at the very end of his life, 4 years before his death, 634 AD. He said this. He said, energy did not belong to person as Sergius said. So one patriarch to another patriarch here. Patriarch of Jerusalem is saying the patriarch of Constantinople's got it wrong. Sophronius is saying energy did not belong to person, as Sergius said, but to nature, the traditional patristic understanding. He said Christ's divine and human natures each had their own distinctive ways of acting. If energy is action and work, well, each nature had its unique action and work. So Christ's divine nature in creation, as John 1, 1 through 3 speaks, the Logos created all things. In his divine nature, there's creation, there's providence, miracles, calming the sea, right? His human nature, though, in is seen in the activity of being born, in growth, in hunger and thirst, sufferings, death, etc. That's the Chalcedonian understanding, expressed in energy terms, in work or activity, that each nature of Christ had its own distinct way of acting, never to be confused, though, never mixed. And Sophronius, this patriarch of Jerusalem, sent a circular letter to the other patriarchs of this statement regarding energy, expressing it with the Chalcedon Creed. He sent that circular letter to Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, and Antioch, the other four patriarchs. Well, Emperor Heraclius tried to get support of Pope Honorius I, who's the Pope of Rome at this time. Honorius, H Honorius. Honorius the First. He was 625 to 638 AD. He was the Pope of Rome. So the emperor, the Byzantine emperor, is trying to get support for this energy thing to bring union with the Monophysites and the Chalcedonians, with the energy thing of Sergius, Patriarch of Constantinople. Well, Honorius I, the Pope of Rome at this time, he sends it even more deep into the weeds, okay, with another view on heresy, a wrong view of Christ. Honorius, the Pope of Rome at that time, rejected energy talk, but suggested Christ had a single will. He said the human and divine natures were united in his single divine will. Which really, when you think about it, denies that Christ had a human will. Is what it denies. Emperor Heraclius is like, oh, I like that idea. Okay, energy won't work of Sergius. Let's go with a single divine will rather than a single energy. So Emperor Heraclius accepted Honorius's view, and he wrote what's called the Ecthesis, E-K-T-H-E-S-I-S, Ecthesis, in 638 A.D., The ecthesis, then, is supporting this view of the Honorius, the Pope of Rome at this time, Honorius I, of a single divine will, uniting the two natures. Those who supported this ecthesis statement were known as the Monothelites. Monothelites. And in Greek, it means single will. Those who embraced a single will. Two people are very important here in rebutting this heresy. Pope Martin I, and he was 649 to 655, Pope of Rome. Pope Martin I, 649 to 655 AD, and as well a Greek monk, Maximus the Confessor, lived 580 to 662 AD. And they were very clear that Christ has two wills, a human will with his human nature and a divine will with his divine nature. That wills go with nature. That's the key question. Does will belong to nature or to person, right? That's the key question. Honorius and Heraclius is saying, well, it's all his two natures are united in a single divine will, so that goes with person, one person. Maximus the Confessor and Pope Martin I, no, will goes with nature. He had a human will with his human nature, divine will with his divine nature. I mean, before studying church history, you're like, I can't believe people thought of all these various ideas, huh? About the person of Christ. This is where, again, falsehoods arise in order that we fine-tune what's right, what's biblical. We know what's wrong, we know what's right. The monothelites, those who believed in a single divine will, said will belongs to person. Christ is of one person. Maximus the Confessor, said will was distinct from person, that will is a part of nature. Maximus said that our will is our ability to desire and to choose. Our will is our ability to desire and choose. Later on in church history, Lord willing, we'll get to Jonathan Edwards, lived 1703 to 1758. And he said, what is the will? The mind choosing, which is a part of our nature. Well, Maximus is saying, our will is our ability to desire and choose. We desire certain things, and when we choose, that's where we have certain choices for dinner, and we desire spaghetti, not a pizza, so therefore I choose spaghetti. You will it to be so. And Maximus said that will then is a part of our nature, just as our ability to think is a part of our human nature. We have a mind, and we can think. Maximus is saying that will is just as essential to our nature as is mind. And Jonathan Edwards would say definitely, because what is the will? The mind choosing. Maximus then is saying the person acts through the mind and will of his nature. A person acts through the will and mind of their nature. And Jonathan Edwards would say, what is the will? The mind choosing. But that's a part of our nature. As a human being, God gave us a mind, and therefore he gave us a will, the mind choosing, to desire and choose something. That's a part of our human nature. Now, in this controversy, remember, this goes back to what we've covered, remember Gregory of Nazianzus, one of the Cappadocian fathers, leading up to, after Athanasius died, 373, the Cappadocian fathers carried on the torch that Jesus is truly God, leading up to the First Council of Constantinople in 381 AD. Gregory of Nazianzus, remember his dispute with Apollinarius in the 370s AD, Apollinarius had said falsely that the divine mind replaced the human mind. If the divine mind replaced the human mind, then Jesus would not be truly human. If he didn't have a human mind. The Council of Constantinople in 381 AD rejected Apollinarianism. Remember, Gregory of Nazianzus said, what has not been taken up cannot be healed. What has not been taken up by Christ cannot be healed. If we have a fallen and sinful human mind. If Christ didn't take up a human mind, then you and I can't have our sinful human mind healed. What has not been taken up by Christ cannot be healed. So if we believe in total depravity, if sin has affected every part of us as humans. So Christ had to become truly, completely human to redeem me completely, truly as a human. If he didn't take up one part of me, I'm in trouble. Then sin still remains in one part of me and in you. The doctrine of salvation is at stake. And you think of Jude verse 3, to contend earnestly for the faith, once for all delivered to the saints. The doctrine of salvation is at stake. What has not been taken up has not been healed. This is that idea. We know that you look at the Old Testament sacrifices of bulls and goats, animals, right? Lambs. I'm a human. I'm not a bull, a goat, a lamb. I need a human substitute, and I need one who's truly, completely human. That's where the eternal Son of God, the Logos, had to take upon himself true humanity in its completeness, yet without sin, as the Chalcedon Creed says. Completely, truly like us, truly human, completely human, yet without sin. So that all of us can be healed. Every single part of our humanness. If the capacity of will belongs to our human nature, and Christ did not have a human will, then Christ was not fully human. Similarly, if he didn't have a human mind, he's not truly human. Well, here as well, with Pope Honorius and Emperor Heraclius asserting that the two natures were united in one single divine will. Well, the dilemma is then Christ did not have a human will. If he did not have a human will, then he was not truly, completely human. And we have one part of us that's still in sin. Doctrine of salvation is at stake. Nick Needham says this of Maximus the Confessor. He was, quote, one of the truly outstanding minds of the Eastern Church in the patristic age, unquote. Indeed he was. Emperor Heraclius died in 641 AD, so his grandson became the emperor. His grandson was named Constans II, C-O-N-S-T-A-N-S, Constans II, who ruled as the Byzantine emperor from 641 to 668 AD. He was, the way Nick Needham describes him, a cruel dictator, and he cared nothing about theology. Cared nothing about theology. Theology is the knowledge of God. This is the fool of Psalm 14:1. Does not want God in his thoughts. This cruel dictator, Constans II, as the Byzantine emperor, issued an edict in 648 AD, and he prohibited, by his edict, by the authority of the emperor, he prohibited all the Byzantine citizens from mentioning anything of wills or energy about Christ. As if that would solve the problem. Some of the Orthodox Christians were not willing to obey the emperor's command, and one was Pope Martin I. Pope Martin I was Pope of Rome from 649 to 655 AD. That edict was issued in 648. Pope Martin I summoned a council at Rome that condemned Constans' edict. As well, that council affirmed that Christ had both a human will and a divine will. Maximus the Confessor played a leading role at that church council in Rome. Interesting, that's in the West. Right? Copies of the council's decisions and their circular letter was sent out through the East and the West, all over in the Catholic Church. That Christ had both a human will with his human nature and a divine will with his divine nature. Two natures united with one person. Chalcedon Creed, 451 AD. In 653 AD, Byzantine troops seized both Pope Martin of Rome and Maximus the Confessor. Constans, the emperor, put them on trial, each separately, for treason in 655 AD. For rebelling against his edict. The trials took place separately. Pope Martin, his was first. Pope Martin was found guilty. He was beaten severely, and he died 6 months later in exile. Maximus at this time was 74 years old. He boldly denied the emperor had any right to interfere in theological matters. There you have again the Western independence of the church being asserted. Remember, as Ambrose of Milan, Bishop of Milan, with Theodosius the Great. In the West, there's this emphasis of independence of the church, both under God, but separation of church and state. That's what Maximus was asserting. He was beaten and banished to Thrace, being found guilty of treason. Thrace is in southeast Europe, north of the Aegean Sea. Think of Macedonia, that period, that area. Maximus continued to speak and write against the monothelites, who were falsely saying that the two natures of Christ were united in a single divine will. He continued to speak and write against it. He was contending earnestly for the faith, once for all delivered to the saints, Jude verse 3. The Eastern Church overall submitted to the monothelites at this time, this false view of Christ. Maximus the Confessor quoted Galatians 1:8. Though we are an angel from heaven, preach any other gospel than the one we have shared, let him be anathema. Let him be damned to hell. Monothelites are preaching a different gospel, a different Christ. What has not been taken up cannot be healed. If Christ did not have a human will, we're all damned to hell. Maximus said this, this is a direct quote, "May God grant that I do not condemn anyone, nor say that I alone am saved, but I prefer to die rather than violate my conscience by defecting from what I believe about God." Unquote. Oh, liberty of conscience. Nick Needham says, "Europe would not see such heroism again until John Huss, H-U-S-S, until John Huss stood alone at the Council of Constance in 1415 A.D. The Czech reformer, standing alone on Scripture in the face of the Catholic Church. And 100 years later as well, Martin Luther, the Diet of Worms in 1521, saying the same thing as Maximus. I cannot violate my conscience. I will not recant. Soldiers punished Maximus by ripping out his tongue and cutting off his right hand, that he might never speak and write anymore. Died a few months later, which is why he is known as Maximus the Confessor. I'll read his quote again. Quote, "May God grant that I do not condemn anyone, nor say that I alone am saved, but I prefer to die rather than violate my conscience by defecting from what I believe about God." Unquote. Yep. May God give all of us the same courage and fortitude with the hope of glory in heaven. Christ our Redeemer. Death is a doorway to heaven. Okay, last section in this part, East, the East Divided. Section number 5 here, the Third Council of Constantinople. It's really 680 to 681. It was called in November of 680 and carried over into 681, the Third Council of Constantinople. Remember, the Second Council of Constantinople was 553 AD. Third Council of Constantinople here is 680 to 681. Emperor Constans was murdered in his bath by one of his servants in 668 AD. Made me think of Matthew 26:52, that he who lives by the sword shall die by the sword, as Jesus said. He got his due in this world. I'm sure he's getting it in the next. Emperor Constans was murdered in 668 AD. His son, Constantine IV, was emperor 668 to 685 AD. Nic Needham describes him as a wise, moderate, popular statesman. Very different than Constans, his father. Constantine IV was a wise, moderate, and popular emperor. In fact, as a side note, he's the first Christian ruler, Constantine IV, the first Christian ruler to crush the forces of Islam in a battle. And that's where we'll get to him next time, Muhammad, Lord willing. But he had his visions, remember, around 610, if I recall correctly. And this is where Islam begins its assault upon the West in the 600s forward. Well, Constantine IV was the first Christian ruler to crush the forces of Islam in battle. And acting with Pope Agatho, A-G-A-T-H-O, who was Pope from 678 to 681 A.D., Pope Agatho of Rome was a loyal disciple of Pope Martin I and Maximus the Confessor, who stood up for the Chalcedon Creed with their lives. Pope Agatho was a loyal disciple of theirs, and he summoned the Sixth Ecumenical Council then. Constantine IV, and he acted with the Pope, Pope Agatho, summoning the Sixth Ecumenical Council in November of 680 AD, what referred to as the Third Council of Constantinople. What's real critical for you and I as Protestants, this is very important, especially for what Martin Luther had to say at the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s AD. The Third Council of Constantinople, the Sixth Ecumenical Council, even though it was only of Eastern bishops that attended it, okay, which is beginning to show that this divide East and West right here. Only Eastern bishops attended this, even though it's referred to as ecumenical of all the known civilized world, but only Eastern bishops attended. But it clearly states at the Third Council of Constantinople that Pope Honorius was wrong with his assertion of a single divine will, and it clearly states that Sergius of Constantinople was wrong in his view of a single energy. It names them. And one of them is a pope of Rome, and says the pope erred on doctrine. Protestants would later use this as evidence that popes can err. An official statement from the Sixth Ecumenical Council, the Third Council of Constantinople, which officially declared a pope can err and make mistakes on doctrine, theological matter. That's one thing Martin Luther was arguing for. Councils can err, popes can err. Sola Scriptura. The scriptures are the final, infallible authority of faith and practice. Not the Pope, not church councils. But this is where you can look in history and say, this is where one ecumenical council declared officially that a pope erred. Pope Honorius, that he was wrong, that the two natures of Christ were united in a single divine will. He's wrong because then it would be saying that Christ had no human will, and what has not been taken up has not been healed, and we'd be still sitting here then with a sinful human will. This was the last ecumenical council to receive recognition in the history of the church. Think of from the Catholics, Protestants, and the Eastern Orthodox, all three main groups of the church. I don't think I wrote it on the board, but Nick Needham did point out later on, there'll be the Second Council of Nicaea in 787 AD. Protestants do not embrace that one because of theological error in it, but Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox accept the Second Council of Nicaea. This Third Council of Constantinople here, where only Eastern bishops attended, shows the separation that's taking place between West and East. And it's moving then eventually to the great schism, the great separation East and West that will occur in 1054 AD. Called the Great Schism in church history. Or eventually it will split. The Catholic Church will officially split East and West. The Great Schism, 1054. But this is how the patristic age ended, the way historians break up church history into ages or periods. This is the end of the age of the early church fathers, the patristic age. And next then we'll be getting into, Lord willing, the second volume out of five volumes of Nick Needham's series, 2,000 Years of Christ's Power, and we'll get into the rise of Islam and the beginning of the Middle Ages. Lord willing, we'll pick it up.